Oh, okay, there we go. All right. So, okay, today I'm with a very special guest, and I'm excited to do this interview. And I, first of all, I'll just say that this project is becoming much more than I ever hoped for. And for those of you that have been following me, I've done some interviews with students, but I haven't yet done any with teachers. And so I'm honored to have a former teacher of mine, Kevin Miller, on the line with me. And he has quite an education background, and not only a teacher of mine, but he's helped many kids through the school system for many, many years. So thank you. I call you Mr. Miller. I don't know what I should call you.
Well, you could call me Kevin, but Mr. Miller is fine, too. Whatever is more comfortable to you.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Miller.
Okay,
so let's get right to the questions. If you don't mind, can you briefly summarize your career and your life as a teacher? Maybe just, you know, maybe a short version of your experience as a teacher, you know, a little bit of your bio,
sure.
Just so people know who you
sure.
are.
Yeah. Well, I came out of graduate school and got a job in Northwest Washington, and got a job at a junior high in Kenmore, next to Bothell, and worked there for 7 years.
And what year did you start, by the way? What year was that you started?
1972 is when I started. So the early 70s, which was interesting historically for American education, because that early part of the 70s, I think, influenced my teaching philosophy a great deal. And it was all about, at that time, it was called open education. And they were trying the philosophy, the new psychology was about taking down the walls. So there were even some schools like Juanita High School that had experimented with not having classrooms at all, taking walls down. Anyway, I was in that area at Kenmore Junior High. We didn't take walls down. We had a fairly traditional junior high experience, and I taught many, many classes there. I think I taught 6 different classes, but that's what you do when you're a junior high teacher. And my major in college was English, so I graduated with a degree in English and then went on to graduate school in English and then earned my teaching certificate. So 7 years there at Kenmore Junior High, where I was a teacher, drama coach, basketball coach, part-time football coach at one time, taught guitar, Spanish, I mean, all kinds of different things. And then in 1979, I got a job because I was looking for a high school job. I really wanted to teach high school, even though I enjoyed junior high experience a lot. So I got a job at Port Angeles High School, and I taught there for 5 years, from 1979 to 1984, and had a great experience there. I was the drama director of a group called the Port Angeles Drama Company, and I was also assistant basketball coach while I was there, primarily taught English at Port Angeles High School and drama. Then 1984, I got a message from my sister, Anna Cortis, who said that one of the English teachers there had retired, and would I be interested? And I was. So I applied for that job, Mrs. McCracken's. And Mrs. McCracken had just retired, and she was quite the, she was a teacher when I was a student at Anna Cortis High School. So I really enjoyed her and her English classes particularly. So I took over for Mrs. McCracken in 1984 as an English, primary English teacher, but also they hired me to direct musical theater in the early mid-80s. So I did that for a couple of years. And then because of the politics, I will call it, of the community theater, who wanted to participate in the high school musical theater productions, which I was all for, but because of the politics of the situation and some of the people that had their feet stepped on that were also high school teachers, that program ended. And in the meantime, I was hired to be the girls' basketball coach at Anna Cortis High School in 1986. And so I did that. And I was also, as you mentioned, as we were talking about a little bit, I was also hired to be the newspaper, what would it be called, advisor/teacher, and I enjoyed that a lot. And I was that and the basketball coach till 1991. I was the newspaper advisor clear up until the late 90s. And then it was in that time period, in the mid-90s actually, when I started I started to promote a program that I was really interested in, which was called an integrated education. So it was about putting together classes that had some connections, so there wasn't such a departmentalization. That was the going term at that time in the mid-90s, trying to do away with the departmentalization of education. And so we created what was called the SHALE, the WHEEL, the WHALE, all acronyms that stood for History, English, and Autonomous Learner. And I team taught with one other teacher. I don't know if you remember him. You probably do. Mark Knight was a teacher that I taught with there in those early integrated programs. And that evolved in about 1996, your senior year, into what was called the REACH program. And that acronym stood for Restructured English Arts Communication History. So it was an attempt to combine three different disciplines into one and be an entirely project-based presentation of education or method of education. So the students were involved in the individually and sometimes in small teams in producing things and working together and then presenting their project. That was a big part of that too. And it was based on a teaching philosophy of Ted Sizer, who was the guru, one of the teacher gurus at the time out of, I think, Brown University or one of those Ivy League schools. And he had written a book and had a whole program about this. And we attempted to follow that philosophy. But for one reason or another, we ran into trouble with, and again, it was politics, and I think we didn't do a good job of informing our fellow teachers about the program and the administration. Initially, behind us 100%, in fact, they came up with, they offered it to us, and I say us, there were three of us teachers together working. That was Mark Knight, me, and John Kastner.
Kastner, yeah.
Yeah, it was the arts, graphic arts guy that was a part of that combination of teachers. So anyway, that all that lasted 4 or 5 years, and I thought was a great program for a lot of kids. Some kids who weren't successful in the regular classroom, the traditional method, book learning, we'll call it, taking a test at the end of the week, the traditional type of learning that was going on and still goes on. They succeeded in our project-based learning because I think it allowed them to break loose, work independently, and then be successful. So as a result of that, I think that was part of our problem too. These kids that formerly weren't successful were getting D's and sometimes flunking in the regular programs were suddenly, not suddenly, but in our program, getting B's and A's. And I think this really bothered a lot of the teachers, and they thought we were handing out grades, and so there was a group of people that got together and tried to do in the REACH program, and they did. They were successful, so that all dissolved, and I went back to teaching. Actually, I got another interesting opportunity to teach what was called distance ed learning within the high school. So I did that in the early 2000s, and it was an attempt by the principal at that time, and with my being the advisor, teacher, to keep students from going to Running Start, because the high school and the school district felt they were losing this money, because the tuition would, the tax money would follow the student over to Skagit Valley. So in order to keep it at Anacortes, our principal at the time, Keith Rattel, who did not like the REACH program at all, by the way, thought this would be a good idea to try to keep students from going to Skagit. They could do distance ed learning. We had a special classroom. But again, I think I think my days were numbered about that time because I saw it, that a lot of teachers didn't like that program either. So anyway, I enjoyed it. I was also then a tennis coach, so I had taken over as head tennis coach when John Kastner moved, and I enjoyed that too. In 2005, I retired, and my wife and I moved to Taiwan, and I taught at two Chinese elementary schools in Taiwan for a brief period of time, too brief, but we enjoyed the experience, and then came back in 2006 And I was still, you know, I was retired, and but I was too young. I didn't want to just go fishing. So I found a job as a college planning advisor in Bellevue. So we moved to Bellevue, and I worked with this college planning company for 9 years in Bellevue, helping individual students and families identify their strengths and help them with finding colleges that they would thrive in, and then help them get into those colleges. And that was a great job, too. And then I retired from that position just a year and a half ago. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Wow. That is great. Thank you for that. I didn't know you had done even, you know, half of those things. That's fantastic.
Well, of course not.
Especially, yeah, that college planning advisor sounds interesting, too. And actually, it might lead to another question for you about it, too. Before I get to that, though, I have some basic ones, because that was a really good overview. What was what's your favorite part, or was your favorite part, about being a teacher? If you had to summarize, your favorite thing about being a teacher?
Well, my favorite thing about being a teacher from year one to the last day was always in the classroom with the students. That was always my favorite part. I have told this to many people. There were some days that were difficult, but not with my students. It was always, the difficulty was always with other teachers and the administration, but not all the time. I had a great career, and I really can't remember a day, one whole day, where I didn't enjoy being at school. So I think that's why I became a teacher, Jesse, partly because I enjoyed school so much when I was in school. I loved it. So, yeah. It was my favorite thing about being a teacher was working with young people, and particularly high school students. Those were the ones I worked with my last years.
Interesting, yeah, and just the whole process of teaching and getting to know them, that kind of just basically being there.
All of that. I enjoyed all of that. I really sort of reveled, loved being with young people who were had different ideas, who were excited and sometimes maybe not excited, but had a different angle to what they were. They weren't just followers of the traditional experience or just lockstep marching their way through high school, which many students do, unfortunately. It's not their fault, but many students do. So I enjoyed that part especially, was the creativity that I felt, not only in the teaching, but also with these young people. That at that time, like you and Scott McKinstry and your musical and everything else that you and Scott and others like you did, that was just, I loved it.
It was a pretty special time. With that being said, what's your least favorite thing, or what was your least favorite thing about being a teacher?
Okay, now I'm going to tell you this truthfully and honestly, because I'm now beyond worrying about it.
My worst
thing about being a teacher was the faculty meetings. I didn't care for those at all. It oftentimes ended up being a gripe session. Sometimes, it just wasn't a pleasant experience. It could have been. I think it could have been a more collegial event where people exchanged ideas and worked towards making something, improving things. But oftentimes people just vented at the faculty meetings. I really got so I hated them. And that was part of my problem too, I think, Jesse. It was part of my problem with relating to other teachers, is they knew I hated those faculty meetings. And so I also hated going into the faculty room. So I quit doing that. So, I wasn't my own best PR guy.
That didn't serve you. We always heard and thought it was amazing that Mr. Clokey never actually went to any teacher meetings. He was the only one that got away with it. No one knows how to this day.
That's not entirely true.
Oh, okay.
He did go to some faculty meetings, but he got out of them for a long time, clear up until, I think the 90s anyway, when the administrators started cracking down, is if you were a coach, you were excused from the faculty meetings.
Right.
So when I was coaching basketball, then I didn't go to the faculty meetings. But then in the 90s, I think Clokey had retired, and he was also a golf coach and assistant football coach. So he had three seasons of coaching that I think he might have done it just to avoid those faculty meetings.
Well, that's my theory.
I think you're right.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, this is good. So how effective – now let's get into a little bit more of the theory and philosophy stuff, which I think you're uniquely positioned to answer because of not just your teaching experience, but also college planning and just being a part of that high school, you know, process for so long. A couple questions about that. So how effective do you think the current educational system is in preparing people for life after high school? I know it's kind of a general, broad way of saying it, but that's okay. I'm open to your broad answer, too.
Well, I think it varies from school district to school district and sometimes from school to school. And again, I think leadership has a lot to do with it. But I do feel a better sense just from what I know about it now. And I've been out of the, let's call it the mainstream education. I mean, I was at college planning, but that was not at a school. But when I was last in the public school in Anacortes 2005, I felt like things were not going in a good direction. But since then, Jesse, I have to tell you, just from what I've read, I think things are turning in a more positive direction. You know, they're talking about project-based learning more and more. I read about that in the newspapers. In some districts, like down here in near Vancouver, Washington, there's a district that's planning to go entirely project-based from K through 12, which I think is, that's a big change, and it takes a lot of courage and a lot of leadership, which I think that, in my experience anyway, I love that philosophy, but I don't think I had much backup from leadership. And I never really wanted to be a principal, even though I probably should have been, but because maybe I would have been more effective, but I never wanted to be. So I tried to make these changes within the traditional system, and I was just too, I couldn't do it. I mean, I couldn't battle the forces that ended up defeating it. But I have a better sense now that things are turning in a more positive direction. I think there's more talk about, at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, I mean, I just have horror stories about when kids got in trouble at Anacortes High School, the principal, instead of bringing them down and having a chat with them, was calling up the police. And the police were coming into the parking lot and handcuffing kids for getting maybe in a scuffle in the hallway or back-talking the teacher or just not following a rule. And they were put in the backseat of the squad car, the Anacortes police, and down to the police station they went. So there was that kind of climate there in the late 90s, early 2000s. It was when you were gone, you were off to college or beyond, and that was not pleasant. I think that is ending. I think there's a big turn in the other direction that is not a good thing to treat students that way. You know, they had those rules about 10 absences, and you flunked the class. I mean, and there was no excuse. What do they call that when they say no excuse? It was just it, hard and fast. They had a panel set up that you could appeal, like if you were out of school for 10 days because you had mononucleosis, then you could appeal and go in front of this panel. But otherwise, it was no excuses. I'm still looking for that word that was sort of the going term of the day. But anyway, I think that is all disappearing now, and there's a turn in the other direction. It's much more humane, I'll call it that.
When you were teaching still, what did you wish you could teach high school students that you weren't able to teach them under that system? Maybe things, because of the way things were run, you weren't able to really do it the way you thought it needed to be done. What would you teach them?
I think that we needed to demonstrate to students that it would have been better if the entire high school was together and there was sort of a pleasant environment of positivity and and helping students was a given across the board, that if a student was having a problem, all the teachers were coming together with the administrators and working to help that student. I think it was the positive. See, I was always, and still am, a believer in positive thinking. And that was a struggle. So I think if that was the struggle to maintain that, when you had a student who was having a problem and they were called out of class and taken down, put in a squad car and sent down to the police. I mean, you can't maintain a positive atmosphere when that kind of
it's tough to stay atmosphere. Positive when the kid's behind bars.
Exactly. Or even just getting the handcuffs on them, which I thought,
right.
Why do they have to do that?
Right. Oh,
so, but that wasn't, I mean, I make maybe too much of that. That wasn't a daily experience.
That happened for a short period of time, it sounds like.
Yeah. So I think the most important thing as a teacher, I don't care if it's high school or kindergarten, the most important thing for a teacher to do is to build confidence. It's the student, that's the most important thing for success, is to have self-confidence. And then, like you and Scott, you had that. You guys were confident enough to write and develop and produce and present a musical. Yeah, to try stuff, exactly. And that openness. But I think that comes from a self-confidence that needs to be engendered. And it's not just the schools. I mean, families also have a big part of that, major part, more important than schools. But anyway, we're just talking about schools here, and I think that is the key, is to instill confidence, to find something in any student, and I know it's there, that they can feel good about or that just it inspires them and to go in a certain direction. And there are, you know this already, there's a multitude, maybe an infinity of directions for students to go. They just need to find it and help and be helped in finding it.
Right. Okay, so let's get to, let's talk about just like those that are about to leave high school for a second, graduating ones, the senior year, you know, or just about to leave. What do you wish you could tell all graduating seniors about life after high school?
That's a good question. I think if I could talk to all of them, I would say trust yourself. I know these are cliches. Don't just follow, go to a college because they've got a big football team. Find your own niche. But that's difficult at that time for a lot of students. A lot of us, I'll include everybody, don't know exactly what their niche is. But many do. But that's what they want to seek, is they want to find the college with the program that inspires them. And they can change, too. That's the other thing I would tell them. Please be open to change. Keep an open mind. Maybe that's the most important thing, Jesse, is maintain an open mind about all the possibilities that are there.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, that's great advice. I was actually just writing that down. That's
okay, I just got this thing flashed up on my phone, so I don't know what that is, but I thought maybe you'd gone. Are you there?
No. Jesse? Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yeah. I think that might have been somebody else telling you something.
Oh, yeah.
This is great. Maintain an open mind, I think, sounds like a huge tip. That's really good.
That is, I think, the most important. I think, you know, even in the general population, we can see that a lot of people in, we'll say the United States, I mean, just the general population, I'm a little bit disturbed by the number of people who don't have an open mind in the year 2016. Seems like there should be more open-mindedness.
Right. Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. What mistakes do you see students making in high school when it comes to thinking about their future and taking action? And basically, what are they doing wrong?
Well, that's a tough one because I think, there's a variation there. Maybe what they are doing wrong is not so much that they're doing something wrong. They're just for one reason or another, they're not equipped to make the right choices, the positive choices for themselves. And so, it's a fact of life. In my well, in my 9 years at that college planning company, I learned a lot. And one of the things I learned was that about 40% of incoming college students, don't, especially boys, for instance, don't make it past their freshman year of college.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They don't make it to the sophomore year. Well, it's a scandal. I mean, it's something that a lot of colleges don't want people to know. And so what's the reason for that? It's not necessarily the college's fault. It's the students that come in there aren't equipped to be independent. Maybe that's what I would say. If you to build independence, and that goes back to our not only our thinking about being open-minded, but also more importantly, I think, than even open-minded, but maybe that is most important, but being confident, self-confident, but independent, so that you don't go to college like many students do, and I know you were there 20 years ago, and I was there a long, long time ago, but it's the same thing, I think, now, is they go to college, and they're not sure what they're doing there, and they're not equipped to make independent decisions, but they're free. So, you know, they end up not going to class and not taking the right classes, and end up getting in trouble of various kinds. So I think that independence is really vital.
And, you know, there's a lot of, what are high school kids and their parents doing right when it comes to preparing, you know, themselves for life after high school? A lot of them are trying hard, so.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that you're right. It's not that everybody's doing the wrong thing. They're not, because there's a lot of students that are very successful, and they go into colleges, I think, with an independent spirit and self-confidence. They may end up following the crowd to this party and that party, but they know how to make decisions for themselves that are primarily healthy. And I don't think that is necessarily taught in the schools, but that's taught in the families. And I think a lot of parents and families are doing a great job there.
But when you talk about independence, do you mean, like, a lot of times that means life skills, you know, how to balance a checkbook, you know, that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Or do you mean knowing what to major in, or, you know, finding your niche, or are you kind of mean a combination of things, or what exactly do you mean by the independence thing?
That's a great question, because now that you've asked it, I'm thinking, okay, what do I mean by independence? I
think right.
It comes back to being confident. So I think that is the key, is to have self-confidence. So if I don't know how to balance the checkbook, I know I can learn it. I can go find it out. I don't necessarily need to take a class. I can learn it on my own. I can find out how to balance that checkbook on my own. I can even ask, and I'm open. If I'm a confident individual, I don't feel stymied to not ask questions. I'm open to asking questions.
Mm.
But I think it's all about having that self-confidence that I think is developed in early years, primarily before people get to high school, but can be engendered and actually introduced and given a chance. For some students who don't have it when they come to high school, they now get it, and then they are better equipped to succeed when they go to college. I will also say, too, Jesse, that I really believe that not all students need to go to college.
That was what I was wondering about next.
I think more and more we're hearing about students going to trade schools again and having more vocational education within the high school, because, quite frankly, a lot of students, they're not interested in reading all the books I have on my shelf. They're interested in working on the car engine or on the, things I don't know anything about. And I don't feel very confident about, to tell you the truth. When my car breaks down, I don't have confidence. I got to get it to the shop. And if my water heater doesn't work, I'm calling the plumber. I mean, that's what I mean. I think there's possibilities there, too, for students. And maybe there's a different route that might include some kind of
trade or
high school diploma, right?
Right.
I think that the country as a whole should value as much as the Ivy League is valued.
Right, right. Sort of that liberal arts education, general education versus your vocational technical college education.
Right, right, right. Yeah. I think that some of that liberal arts is important because I think it's important for people in the trades, and I know there are teachers there that would say, yeah, they nod their head, yeah, that's a gift. But they need to have some of the liberal arts background too, literature, arts of sorts, because that builds a more dimensional life. A multidimensional life.
What's the biggest problem? Like, if you had, there's some various different things we've talked about, but if you had to boil it down, what is the biggest problem you see for high school graduates, right at that particular age, you know, in that time when they graduate?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to sound like I'm repeating myself, Jesse, but I really think the biggest problem is their inability to go out on their own, to be independent. They haven't been given the muscles to whatever that means, muscles of self-confidence to make independent decisions and to live an independent life. That's the biggest problem.
They want to stay home with mom and dad type of thing or stay with the small town or their friends?
Yeah, or they want to go to, and it's not necessarily a bad thing for students to go to Skagit Valley College or up to Western. I mean, there's more comfort there and, of course, less expense, which for a lot of families is crucial. But I didn't exactly mean that. I meant that if that's an independent decision based on the student's strength student's weakness wanting to be with mom and dad, you know, a lot of people do.
I think what I'm hearing is being independent, part of that has to do with the self-confidence, which you said before.
Right.
And it's independent thinking is what you're saying versus working and kind of thinking, hey, there's hope and there's an abundant life versus the scarcity mentality of, oh, I better do this and that out of fear. I don't even want to go to that school, but I'm going to go because I think I should, you know, somebody else is thinking for me kind of stuff. Is that maybe what you're referring to?
Absolutely. That's right. Independent thinking. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. And so here's one more. Knowing what you now know, and this is more personal, just for fun. Knowing what you now know through all this experience in life, and if you could write your 18-year-old self a letter and send it back in time, you know, like if you could give yourself advice when you were that age, maybe encouraging, maybe warning yourself or directing your life somehow, what would you say or what would you write in that letter?
Well, that's a great question. I like that. I think if I wrote that letter back to myself at 18 years old, I would have told myself, don't put so much time and effort into sports, because that was big in my life when I was 18 years old. And I went off to college to Pacific Lutheran University, not because I thought I could get a good education there. I went off there because they were giving me a basketball scholarship. And I would say, in that letter, I would also say, don't put so much time and effort into sports. Put time and effort into music and writing and things that are going to be more of a lifetime, have more value for the life than just that short period of time when you're young and you can run around.
Wow, that is fascinating. I really am glad you said that. That sounds very personal and maybe even tough to admit for some people, and especially all the pro sports folks out there. Pro meaning, you know, we need more sports in school. Going to maybe ruffle a few feathers just saying that.
Well, yeah, maybe. I really feel seriously about it, and it is very personal, and it could be different for a lot of other people. They might not think that way. They might think, well, I'm really glad that sports meant so much to me because now I'm a diehard Seahawks fan and that sort of thing. But
right. Well, the Seahawks usually aren't sending them a check for watching the game on Sunday, though. So
no, they're not. But they do. The diehard fans, that is a big part of their life. They enjoy it a lot. But for me, I ended up enjoying musical theater. I was in productions after I got out of college, you know, and my wife was a musician and singer in the choir in college. And I feel like, gee, I would have loved to do that rather than going out there and running up and down the basketball court and thinking I was a big deal.
Oh, that's great. Awesome. Thank you for that. I've got a bonus question, if you
okay.
don't mind. This one's kind of more about, you know, this topic in general, because everything you've said has been hugely valuable already. So I'm just kind of rolling with it here. But what kind of information, resources, interviews, or other ideas do you think need to be included in this book to make it a valuable resource for high school students and parents? And, you know, it's called Life After High School, Secrets mm-hmm. to a Successful Life by Those That Had 20 Years to Think About It, or more in
yeah.
your case. And I really want this to be for high school students and for parents. And I don't know which one's going to be more likely to read it, probably parents of the high school students. But
probably.
You know, I'm thinking if you're looking for a resource to help your kid, I know for a fact in my life that when I was a teenager, I often didn't listen to my parents, but I might listen to my coach or my teacher
right.
that I liked, and I might listen to a friend's parents or somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, it's like third-party credibility, right? Like,
yeah,
I can't,
exactly right.
you know what, you don't trust, you know, that person closest to you because you're too familiar with them. But somebody
yeah.
else you don't know as well for some reason you listen to. So that's kind of
yeah.
what I want for this. And, you know, what kinds yeah. of things do you think I need to include to make it valuable for them?
Well, I think you want to, and I know you will, Jesse, but you want to make sure you're staying on a positive tone throughout. I think that's real important. I mean, there's lots of problems, of course, but I think there are more solutions, and you want to be upbeat. But I think also a more practical advice might be to include some of these, have a good bibliography where parents, interested people, could go and look at maybe Theodore Sizer's Essential Schools, I think was his philosophy.
Okay.
And that, so have his yeah. Maybe a book. He wrote several. But that I would create a bibliography. Don't make it too much, though, because people get turned off with too long a bibliography. But
right,
maybe
right,
one page
right.
of real important, of what you see as important books for parents, teachers, and students to look at if they want to.
That's great. What was that? What was Theodore's? What's his book title again that you mentioned?
Well, his program, his philosophy was called Essential Schools.
Okay, and he has a few books.
Yeah, yeah. And I think if you Googled or searched his name, Sizer is S-I-Z-E-R, you're going to find a lot of information.
Okay,
and,
I'm definitely going to look that up. That's thank you for
yeah.
that. That's if no one else looks it up, I will at least, and I'll go and
yeah,
read it.
Yeah, that mattered a lot to us and to me especially. And then in the 70s, the open concept schooling philosophy, I'm trying to think of a guy's name off the top of my head, but none's coming to me right now, but I read, you know, Jonathan Kozol.
Okay.
K-O-Z-O-L. And he wrote a lot of books that influenced me a great deal and had that kind of same philosophy about focusing on the individual student rather than the group of students.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And that was part of that whole open concept of the 70s I was telling you about. And I experimented with it in my early days in that junior high. I had a class, let's say I had a class of 30 students in my block of time English social studies class. And each one of them I had a folder for. And I was going to try to do this individualized education. And it was my first year of teaching, and it just almost put me in an early grave because to do individualized education with a group of eighth graders that have never had it before, and you're trying to meet with each student 15 minutes a day, and then you could only meet with them because there's 30 of them maybe every 3 days and design a program for each one of them. I mean, it was impossible. So
just crazy.
I had nightmares. I couldn't sleep at night, and I finally bailed out of that after 6 months and went to kind of a, mix of individualized and group. And
you synthesized it a little bit with the traditional method.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how did that go, by the way?
I survived because of that. Yeah, that was much better.
Oh,
fascinating. And you have to do that. As a teacher, you know, you want to survive.
Right.
You want to be successful.
Yeah, yeah. Can you think of any other high school teachers or counselors that'd be interested and maybe willing to do an interview with me?
Well, you know, I wish that Keith Anderson was still alive. He would have been a great one, but you can't interview him because he's not. I'm just thinking of my own experience here and people that might still be available. I think Scott Burnett that you're going to talk to is a good one.
Yeah, oh, great.
He's a terrific teacher and a terrific person. And I know he carries some of the same philosophies I do. He did not particularly care for our REACH program, but I think it was because of some of the things we were doing that weren't quite right in terms of independence of movement of those REACH students. And that was our problem, too, that we didn't handle as good as we should have. But Scott would be a good one. I think that Ruth Backlund was another great teacher who had the same kind of philosophy she was just a great teacher. So remember her? She taught French.
Yes.
She would be a good one if you can get. She's retired, I think, now. I would certainly recommend her. That principal at Anacortes High School now, John Rundgren, he was a counselor, but you weren't there when he came in as a counselor.
No.
He was a young counselor in the early 2000s, and then he went off and got his principal's credentials, and I think he worked 1 year in Burlington or somewhere else, and then applied and got back into Anacortes as a vice principal, and then after I was gone, he became principal.
Huh.
But a good guy, and really a good person. He would be a good person to talk to and get sort of that angle from an administrative angle. Yeah.
Well, this has been so awesome. I really appreciate all your time and your answers, and you opened my mind up to a lot of new ideas too. And,
oh, good.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add that maybe I didn't cover, or that you wanted to, you know, last words or anything that you want to add?
Yeah, I haven't got anything else to say. I feel like I've talked an awful lot and haven't given you much of a chance at all. But that's the way I am. I'm a big talker. But
Desi, right.
I got your phone number now, so if I think of something, I'll get a hold of you, maybe text you, and you've got my phone number. You could text me, too, anytime you have a question, or if you want to call me, and we could talk down the road.
That'd be great. I will. And what I'm going to do is, if it's okay, I'll probably email you, you know, some things when I get them up on the website. You can maybe have a look at it. This is going to be quite a project, and I'm I said, I'm still in the research phase, so it may be a while, but I'll definitely keep you, you know, in the loop too.
Well, I appreciate that. And how do I find your blog?
Right now, I've got all this on my main writing, my author's blog, which is just jessestoddard.com, JesseStoddard.com. And I put all kinds of stuff on there, including some of my humor and comedy and op-eds and essays and whatnot. But and a lot of goofy stuff on there too. But there's some good content here, and this is going to be a little bit bigger project, so I'm excited about it.
Yeah. Oh, great. And I have one last question for you. What is Scott McKinstry doing?
Let me end this. Hold on really quick here on this recording thing.